preach Christ unto you. And you know, for the last couple of weeks now, I've been getting ready for this service, getting ready for this moment together. You know, it's on Easter where everyone seems to come out to church. It's a wonderful thing. We're excited about it. And so with that, you know, as a preacher, you want to be your best. You want to put your best foot forward. You want to be your sharpest. And wear an Easter tie. It's the only Sunday I'll wear pink. And so on Monday, I had pulled together a whole bunch of Easter sermons that other people have preached and listened to a lot of other preachers. And all day, I'm just waiting for something to bear witness with my heart, something I should preach, something I could say. And I was listening to a preacher this morning, and he said, you know, as a preacher, you have to wait on the tell it. And he said, when you're listening to something that you should preach, there'll be a tell it that arises in your heart. And when the tell it is there, no one has to tell you to tell it. You just tell it. Like a dog barking. The bark's in the dog. That's why he's barking. The bark is in him. And so as a preacher, especially as one who desires to be led by the Holy Spirit, we could have crafted any number of different messages to preach to you guys. But I was waiting on the tell it. Waiting on something in my heart that I should say. And I went all day Monday listening to all these different sermons, and not one bore witness with me. And finally on Monday night, it was about, I guess, 10:30. Normally I'm in bed by then, but the house was quiet, and I decided to take advantage of the quiet time and just be alone with the Lord and not focus on trying to find anything to preach or say, but just be with Him. And I picked up this book just to read, to draw near to the Lord and have some time of devotion with Him. And the book, it's not divided in chapters like most books are, where it's trying to build upon a theme. Rather, there are about 25 chapters within the book, and each chapter is only about 2 to 4 pages. And each chapter is telling a different story, and out of each story, there's supposed to be a central point that's drawn from that story. And the first story I opened up immediately bore witness with my heart. The tell it came. There's a story about this preacher who wrote the book. He went over to another missionary's home for a Sunday brunch after the Sunday service. And this preacher and his wife were over at the home of this missionary and his wife. And they had a little girl named Lauren, who was 2, and she was playing with a little girl who was the little girl of the missionary, who was 3. And they were all just fellowshipping, and the preacher who was writing the book, he was standing in the kitchen. Everyone else was in the living room just fellowshipping after lunch. And the 2 girls were outside playing. Well, they were playing in the front yard, and you could see them out the window. And so even though they were young, it wasn't that big of a deal because you could see them play. But I guess they got so involved in the conversation that they took their eyes off of the little girls. And the little girl somehow, some way, wound up in the backyard. And the problem with that was, is there's a pool in the backyard with no fence around it. And the little 2-year-old girl didn't know how to swim. And so while the adults are in the house fellowshipping and laughing and having a good time, the little 3-year-old busts through the doors and screaming with tears running down her cheeks, saying, the little 2-year-old is in the pool. Well, the little 2-year-old couldn't swim. Everyone immediately rose up in panic, as you could imagine if that was your child, how you would respond. Everyone immediately rose up without any other prompting than the prompting that came from their own soul, and they ran out to the swimming pool. And here's this little 2-year-old girl, face first in this water. The missionary jumped in first, followed by everyone else, and they grabbed the girl and immediately began to resuscitate her, to try to bring life into her, and thank God she lived. She spat up just a stomach full of water, tears just weeping coming down her cheeks, and Of course, the parents were crying too. And the man who was writing the book said, for the rest of the day, that little girl held on to him. And he held on to that little girl. And he said, you know what? That night, it wasn't a chore putting her to bed. You know, there'd be other nights where you're tired and, you know, you don't feel like doing it. But he said, that night, no one had to prompt me to put her into bed. It wasn't a hassle praying over her that night. I wasn't wanting to run to a TV program. He said, the next morning, he said, I couldn't do anything but look at her. All I wanted to do was just be with her and to tell her how much I loved her. And he said, I realized something that day. He said, I realized that there had been a thief in my life. A thief called Common. You see, so oftentimes we know this as Christians. I'm sure you've heard it before. Jesus said, I've come that you may have life and that you may have it more abundantly. And the thief, he's come to steal, kill, and destroy. So oftentimes when we think of the enemy being a thief, we think he wants to take away what we had. But he's got a subtle practice. And it's not to take something away from you, but rather to cause you to take what you have for granted. That's what happened to that preacher that day. See, he had love in his life always, but he said for the last several years of his life, he had gotten so caught up in work that this thief called Common had stripped away his passion for his family. Had stripped away his passion even for the Lord. See, that's what the thief called Common does. He comes into our lives and creeps into our marriages and creeps into our families. And instead of that face that we saw when that child was born that lit up our hearts, it's just a common face. We can take it for granted. Instead of remembering what it was like to be passionately in love with a spouse, we replace nightgowns with recliners and just sit back and live with each other. But we've let the thief called Common steal that joy that should be there. The only way to stop that is to awaken. To awaken to the love that is in your life right now. To awaken to the things that used to bring you joy that the thief called Common has stripped away. To not allow petty frustrations in life to rob us of the romance of life that we're supposed to have. The thief called Common, has he taken anything from you? It's still in your life, but is the passion still there? Is the life still there? You know, I could go any number of different ways with that. Could preach, I'm sure, a series with it. But as I was reading that, I couldn't help but think about Easter. About the cross on Calvary, about Jesus rising again from the grave. It's a story that all of us know, even if all you do is come to church on Easter. You've heard that message. We all know it. We live in the deep South. There's a church on every corner. We know the story of what Jesus did. We've heard of the nails that were driven into his hands and the spear that was driven into his side and the scourging that took place on his back. We know what he did. We know how he did it. But have we really focused on the why? Why Jesus climbed up on that cross? They didn't nail him to it, friend. Jesus said, no man can take my life. I lay it down. I choose to lay it down. Why the cross? Have you ever lost something that meant the world to you? I mean, really meant the world to you. Have you ever lost anything like that? I remember years ago, I went to a camp meeting type of service, and I took my father's preaching Bible with me, one that he had crafted the cover to, and I took it up there, and in the chaos of the meeting, some way or another, that Bible got lost, and I think someone may have picked it up by accident. I hope it was by accident. But I never will forget, over the next couple of days, the only thing I could think about was finding what I had lost. Maybe you just have lost something little, like a pair of keys, and you could have a million and one other things to do that day, but you know until you find those keys, you can't move to anything else. And so during that process of time where you're looking for those keys, you're not thinking about the bills. You're not thinking about all you have to do that day. When you have lost something like that, the only thing you can think about is getting back what you lost. Much less when you've lost someone that you've loved. I remember a story my sister-in-law was telling me, Lee. She took her family to Disney World a number of years ago. And, you know, if you've ever been to Disney, you know that it is a vacation, but at the same time, it's a workout. You're walking from sun up to sundown. You get tired very quick, especially when you go during the summer and it's real hot. And so she took her family out there to Disney, and she has a little 3-year-old boy at that time. Now he's older, named Jackson. And they decided to come back to the hotel that day to take a nap and rest before they go back to the parks again that night. And so they're all in the hotel room ready to take a nap. They all lay down, and Jackson, at age 3, he realizes that everyone's asleep, and this is his opportunity, this is his time. Because when he walked into that hotel, he saw an arcade out in the lobby, and he knew if there was ever a time to play the arcade, this was it, buddy. This was it. So he waited for everyone to fall asleep, and he went over to the door and unlatched it and creeped it open and just slipped out very quick, stood by the door for a second, I'm sure, to make sure no one came out, and ran over to the arcade. Well, you can imagine when everyone was awake, they noticed Jackson is not here. That's an issue. That's a problem. Now, I don't know if anything like that has ever happened to you, but you know in that moment, the only thing anyone in that family is thinking about is recovering what was lost. Going after who was lost until they are found. And so they call the front desk and they tell them, oh, my 3-year-old, he's crept out. His name is Jackson. And so all the hotel staff is looking for him, and so they run out of the hotel room and they're running the grounds trying to find he who was lost. And they come to the arcade, and at the arcade they see a crowd of people around this little kid doing a kung fu move, screaming at the top of his lungs, "Stranger danger." And all of these people are trying to recover him and take him back to his mother, but he's not going to let any stranger take him anywhere. You know the joy that they experienced when they recovered their son who was lost. Decades and decades ago, God created a man named Adam and a woman called Eve, all for the sole purpose of starting a family, of having a son and a daughter that he could love and show affection towards. He didn't create them as slaves. He gave them the choice to choose him. He could have created them and hardwired them where there was no opportunity not to choose him. But he didn't want that. He didn't want bondage. There can never be any bondage in love. Love produces freedom. He didn't want bondage in his son's life. He gave the opportunity to the son to choose me. And we know that Adam made a mistake and he chose to go against the will of the Lord, and sin came into the earth. And at that moment, mankind was lost. When you've lost something, it consumes you until you find it. It is a consuming love that drives you to recover what you lost. I don't know if you've ever had consuming love before for something. I think back to when I first started dating my wife, Peppy. Oh, I met her, and tell you what, immediately, oh, I tell you, just thrilled at the opportunity to be able to just to date her. When we started talking marriage, oh, you talk about consuming love. Phone calls and text, and she lived in Birmingham, Alabama, was going to college there. I would preach on Wednesday night, then drive 3.5 hours to go see her for about 2 hours on Thursday, then drive all the way back. And I tell you what, I didn't mind the drive. Glad to do it. Thankful to do it. Why? That consuming love drives you. When you're in consuming love, that's all you're thinking about. See, in our lives today, I'm sure this week, there are a lot of things that you've thought about. A lot of things that you could do or had to do. Maybe hobbies that you did this week. Maybe watch sports. Lots of things were on your mind this week. But did you know with God, He has no hobbies? He doesn't have a hobby. The only thing that God thought about this week was you. The only thing He thought about last week was you. The only thing He lives for, His heart beats for, that ignites His passion is you. It's a consuming love. In the book of Isaiah, He says, shall a mother forget her children? He says, yeah, she may forget, but I will not forget you. Behold, I've engraven you on the palm of my hand. Have you ever wrote something on your hand? Why did you write it there? So that you wouldn't forget it. Maybe you wrote a phone number that you needed to call. Why did you write it on your hand? You wrote it there so you wouldn't forget it. God said, I've engraven you on my hands. Why? I'm never going to forget you. He's been consumed by us. Well, why? What's He want from us? He wants the same thing He wanted from His man Adam. He's hoping that throughout your life and throughout the ages of time, if He shows you enough signs of His goodness, if He shows you enough signs of His mercy, and you see those signs, that your heart will awaken to the love that He has for you. That you choose, you make a choice to give your life to Him. Not out of religion because I have to. Not out of I need to do this, but out of a love for Him. That the signs that He shows you in this life are big enough and great enough to steal your affections and win your heart. To draw you to Himself. He did this throughout the ages, and finally He sent the ultimate Son. His Son Jesus. He tore apart His family to bring the family back together. And He sent His Son Jesus, born of a woman on this earth. This child grew up and waxed strong, grew in grace, grew in wisdom, became a full-grown man and begin producing miracles. Signs. Why the signs? Why the wonders? Why the miracles? Yes, to be good to people. But He did them as signs of the Father's love. Saying things, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Why would He show them signs? Why would He show them wonders? Why would He show them miracles? Why does He show us those things today? It's so that we awaken from the sleep that we're in, that we realize this thief called common. may be stealing away our passion for the thing that really matters most. And our hearts awaken to the fact that God loves me. Not just loves me in passing, loves me, but He loves me. He did all of these things, and still He asked men, "Who do men say that I am?" They said, "Well, some people say you're a good man, some people say you're a prophet." Still, the world did not get it. And He was God in the flesh, showing a hurting, lost world a relentless pursuit of them. So He did something amazing. He produced a sign that we still look at today. He gave the world a sign that some of you this morning have around your necks. He gave a sign to the world that we would put in front of churches and on tops of steeples. The sign was the cross. Yes, it was a place of agony. Yes, it was a place of torment. But above all of that, it was a sign to mankind that I will never let go of you. It was a sign to all of mankind that says, look and see how much I love you. They took our Savior, they took our King, and they beat Him across His back, literally opening up His back with the wounds that they gave. Made Him carry His cross up a hill. Put a crown of thorns on His head, mocking Him, calling Him the King of the Jews. And then they took Him and nailed Him to a cross. The cross doesn't kill you. It's what the cross does. On the cross, they take a nail and they put it right in between your wrist, right before your hand begins, right there and right there on either side. And you hang, and then they put a nail right in your feet. And the way the cross kills you is by asphyxiation. You can't breathe. You can't catch a breath. You can inhale, but in order to exhale, you don't have enough strength in your lungs because all of your body weight is resting upon them to breathe. So the only way to breathe is to lift yourself up with your arms, to pull up, and to push with your feet up, just to exhale a breath. That's how men died on the cross. You can imagine our Savior Jesus having to do that with His back that was just opened up by scourging, rubbing against a wooden post. Just for one breath, excruciating pain. The Sabbath was approaching. And so they said, we need to come and we need to break the legs of all the men on the cross. The reason why they would break the legs is because once they broke them, you couldn't push up with your legs anymore, thereby not catching a breath. If you couldn't catch a breath, then you would be dead in a matter of minutes. Some people would hang on the cross for as many as 3 days before they died. But if they would break the legs, you couldn't push up anymore. So they broke the legs of the first two, but they got to Jesus. And they were amazed that He was already dead. He shouldn't have been dead at that point. So they didn't have to break His legs, and that fulfilled a prophecy that no bone of His would be broken. What's amazing is I was reading a report from the American, I forget the exact phrase, but it was by doctors who produced a report back in 1986. About how Jesus must have died. He said He probably did not die of asphyxiation. They said when they stuck that spear in His side, it must have punctured His right lung and went into His heart. And that made blood and water flow. But even at that point, He was dead. And they said the only way for blood and water to flow at that time was if Jesus' heart had exploded. Jesus didn't die from a crucifixion. He didn't die from asphyxiation. He didn't die from wounds on His back. He died from a broken heart. on that cross, his love for all of mankind was so enlarged. It cost him his life. Why did he do it, friend? He did it as a sign. Will someone awaken? Will someone see that I will go this far for you? That even in your worst sin, even if you're nailing me to the cross, I will make excuses for you. Why? My relentless pursuit. He laid down his life on that cross to show the world, my love for you will go this far. I will lay down my life for you. Reminded of a story, I told it a number of years ago. There was a father who was a train operator. And his job was to sit in this little booth decades ago and let down a train. The train tracks would run over a bridge, and so ships would have to come underneath the bridge. And when ships would pass by, they'd have to lift the train tracks up. Well, ships passed by more than trains came, so the majority of the time, the train tracks were up. And on this particular day, his son came with him to work. His son was just a little guy, around age 5. And where the train operation was a good 300 yards away from the train tracks that would actually lay down. Well, how the deal worked is they would have sensors that would tell the train operator when a train is coming so he knew when to put the train tracks down. But for the last couple of weeks, the sensors had been out, and so he would have to eyeball it. He was in an open enough plane to where he could hear and see a train coming in a far enough distance away that he could actually let the train tracks down. And on this particular day, when his son came with him to work, his son was over playing by the bridge, playing by the train tracks. Just in a one in a million type of situation, his son got caught in the grinds and in the system that lowered those train tracks. He got caught in the grooves of that thing and couldn't get out. And so the father was going over to get him out. No big deal. But as he was going to get him out, he saw a train coming. He's 300 yards away from his son, and he knows he's got to let down these train tracks immediately. And so he looks out in the distance, and he decides he's going to make a run for his son. But he looks out, and he realizes that the train is not an industrial train. It's a passenger train. If it's an industrial train and there's an accident, you know, no one will lose their life. But with the passenger train, if there's an accident, everyone on the train could lose their life. So in a moment, he's torn. What do I do? If I don't save my son, he will die if I lower these train tracks. But if I don't lower these train tracks soon, everyone on the train will die. What do I do? You can imagine the weight that was on the father at that moment. He made a decision. He couldn't run and save his son and at the same time lower the train tracks. And he thought about all the other parents that were on that train, all the other kids who were on that train. And so he figured the lesser of two evils was to take the life of his son. As the train was approaching, he went and lowered the train tracks. And in agony on his knees, watched as the train tracks lowered. His son died on that day. And right when the train tracks clicked, the train began passing by. Everyone on the train was completely unaware of the sacrifice a father just made to save their life. On his knees out there outside of that little operational hub in a field, he's on his knees crying, just wanting someone to take notice, someone to see his pain. when Christ was on Calvary, hollered out the words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why did he? Why did he give his only son? In the hopes that someone in this world would take notice of the son and give their love to the God who loved them. In Luke chapter 15, Jesus tells an interesting story. You don't have to turn there. I'll just read it to you. In Luke chapter 15 and verse 1, and in fact in all of Luke chapter 15, Jesus gives three parables. In verse 1, we see, then drew near unto him all the publicans and sinners. These were the worst of the worst. Not living by any type of principles, any type of moral standards. Publicans and sinners. The reason why we are able to know that they were publicans and sinners, they looked like publicans and sinners. So you have all of these people drawing near unto Christ to hear his words. But that's not the only crowd who's there. Then drew near unto him all the publicans and sinners for to hear him. And the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, this man receiveth sinners and eateth with them. So not only are sinners there pressing in to hear Jesus, but also there's Pharisees there. And these guys live by the law. I mean, they live by extreme moral standards. They're going to synagogue each and every week. They know the Old Testament like the back of their hand. They could quote it to you. So you got these two types of people there hearing Jesus' words. And watch what Jesus tells them in verse 3. He spake this parable unto them, saying, what man of you, having 100 sheep, if he lose one of them, doth not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after that which is lost until he finds it? Notice, when does the pursuit of what is lost stops? He's saying that I will never ever give up on you until I find you. That my pursuit of you, it will not stop until you are in my arms safe and sound. I will not stop pursuing you until I find you. He goes on saying, verse 5, and when he hath found it, he layeth it on his shoulders, rejoicing. Why would he do that? Because oftentimes these sheep who were lost had hurt themselves in some way. And he knew for them to walk back with them, it could be painful. So instead of rebuking the sheep for running away and getting hurt, he picked the sheep up and carry it, put it on his shoulders. And when he hath come home, he called together his friends and neighbors, saying unto them, rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost. Jesus has all of these lost people hearing his words, and what he's telling them is this: I will never give up on you. I will never stop my pursuit of you. If you run from me, I will run after you until I find you. And when I find you, even if you're hurt because you ran, I will not condemn you. I will not rebuke you. I will pick you up on my shoulders, nurse you back to health, bring you back to the flock, and rejoice that you are safe and sound. God's pursuit of you does not stop until you are in his arms. And even if you're there one time and go off again, guess what he does? He pursues. There may be two kinds of people here today. There may be one who would kind of fit into the category of a publican and sinner. For whatever reason, you've run away from principles. You've lived a life of regrets. Now you just want to be clean again. You want to be holy and you want to live for God. Maybe there's someone else here, another type of person. Someone who has lived by principles like the Pharisees. Comes to church out of religious duty. But it's being done out of religion versus out of relationship. See, God's heart is that you see how much He loves you, that your heart awakens to that love, and you start laying aside things and doing things, not because the preacher tells you to, but because the love that you have for your risen King compels you to. You long to worship Him. Jesus ended Luke chapter 15 with the story of the prodigal son, a publican and sinner, one who ran away but had an experience with his father and awakened to the father's love and ran back to him. But then you had another son in the house who did all the right things, did all the chores, did all the good things, but he hears about the love of the father and it makes him angry because he's wondering if this sinner and this publican is getting all of this love, who spent all of this money on prostitutes, where's the love for me? Father said, son, all that I have is yours. What's he saying? Awaken to my love. Friends, the cure for Christianity is not more rules. The cure for Christianity is not trying to inspire people to be more moral. The cure for Christianity is people on both sides, sinners and publicans and those entrapped by religion, to awaken to the love that God has for them. It's when their heart is awakened to God's love, they lay aside all of these other things. They go to church. They pray. They worship because they love Him. Their heart has awakened to all the signs that He's shown. The cross on Calvary, that was a sign of how much He loved you. An empty tomb, that's a sign of how much He loves you. That inspiration you get when you worship, that's God giving you a sign of how much He loves you. That pulling on your heart at a party when everyone else is having fun, but you're sitting there empty, that's God's never-ending pursuit of you. Sitting in a recliner wondering, there's got to be more than life, that's God's pursuit of you. That's Him pulling at your heart, trying to get us to awaken to His love. That's what Easter is all about, friend. It's a sign to both sinner and saint saying, will you awaken to the love that I have for you? Will you draw near to me because you love me? You love me because you see how very much I love you. That's what Easter is all about. Every head bowed. Every eye closed. If you're in this place this morning, and I haven't said any of this to pull on your heartstrings,